Okay, thanks, and thanks for sticking around before the lunch break. Thanks to my co-session presenters. I've learned a lot today. I've been learning a lot also recently, so I want to say in advance that this is more of a progress report or, you know, some ongoing work that I'm going to be presenting today. I just recently started thinking about it, so I really would welcome the feedback at any level, including during the talk. So, originally I had stratus, but I think stratocumulus is probably a better descriptor of these stable layers in the solar system. So it's kind of a broader perspective I'm hoping to bring to the problem. And hopefully you'll find that it ties in pretty well with what my co-presenters have shown. So my original motivation, just a couple months ago, was that this observation on Venus, actually, that Venus has a global cloud deck of sulfuric acid. That's well known. It's been known for a long time. But it turns out that observationally, they deepen with a lowering amount of insolation. So what I mean by that is they deepen both on the night side and towards the poles. And this is one example, just showing tropopause altitude, which is kind of, you can think of this as a capping inversion, but here it's sitting at 60 kilometers elevation, so it's way up in the atmosphere, way away from the surface boundary layer. And you can just see the tropopause altitude rising towards the poles, and then something else happening at the poles here. My original motivation actually came from this paper, which, no offense, but they have the wrong interpretation, because they're saying it has to do with infrared upwelling changing with latitude and from day to night. But we know that stratocumulus is actually driven from by cooling from above, which I'll get into in a second. So here's a picture in the UV of Venus. And you know, if you sort of, especially if you took this panel, you might think that that was just some old data for stratocumulus on Earth. So I think there's some similarities here, but again, it's global. It is variable. And since it's global, it accounts for 70% albedo of Venus. So you're probably familiar with the hellish conditions at Venus's surface, 750 Kelvin. But actually, the emission temperature is, to space, the OLR, is lower than that of Earth because it absorbs less sunlight than Earth. Okay, so the big picture for me is what sets planetary albedo. That's really the big question for me. So on Earth, we know I don't need to belabor this, stratocumulus covers more than any other cloud type on Earth. This is a great review by Rob Wood, do I have that? By Wood that Chris pointed out to me late last week, even. It's a very good read. Earth, to me, in a planetary perspective, is kind of an outlier in the sense that it has a large clear sky component. And we're ignoring Mars here because it really, to my mind, doesn't have an atmosphere. Venus has this global cloud deck of sulfuric acids with albedo of 70% or so. Titan, which is not a planet, it's the largest moon of Saturn, has a global stratospheric smog layer. Probably different things going on there, but some of this might some of this thinking might apply there as well. And then the gas giants and ice giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, all have global and or alternating zones of cloud coverage. And then there's exoplanets, and this is really the Wild West out here, where people are talking about these are different temperature pressure profiles, these solid lines. And you just overlay the phase curves or the saturation vapor profiles of these different constituents. So for instance, here's iron in one of these hot Jupiter atmospheres. There's magnesium silicates, which are rocks, probably condensing out at these temperatures. How does that work? No one really understands that. Are they global? Is there a diurnal cycle? And actually, you might sort of scoff at this, but actually the test satellite, NASA's recent launch actually from Vandenberg that Brad was describing. Was that the test satellite? Or was it something else?
I think TESS launched from...
TESS was the Atlas V from Florida, that's right. Okay, a few weeks earlier it launched from Florida. It's going to be bringing in a bunch of data, including measurements of albedos of these planets. a very hard measurement, but they're doing it. Astronomers are doing it. So I think I'm going to mostly skip over this, just to point out that the stratocumulus mode is driven from above by long wave cooling. That's really kind of, to me, was the new principle. Okay, so from now on, I'm just going to develop this sort of rough framework for understanding cloud formation. Hang on 1 second. Yeah, that's better. So again, fundamentally, we're thinking of stratocumulus being driven by radiative cooling from the top. If that's the way they're driven, then they have to have unit optical thickness at least to generate enough buoyancy flux to drive, to sustain the cloud. You also need a minimum flux of kinetic energy to prevent the hydrometeors from settling out. So that will become important. And in a bulk sense, this radiative cooling from the top, from this optically thick top layer, has to balance the latent and sensible heat fluxes that are driving the cloud, and then generate kinetic energy with some given efficiency. Okay, so you're driving it with a buoyancy flux. Some of that is going into kinetic energy, a relatively small amount. But that small amount is what ends up being available to keep those hydrometeors lofted. And the dissipation on the hydrometeors implies a limit, a lower limit on, you know, how much buoyancy flux for a given efficiency that you need. So so let's get into it then, unless there are questions about that. Are we all on the same page? Just sort of. Okay, so first of all, this is the way I think of heat engine efficiency and boundary layers. If you just take a sort of an enthalpy flux here assume that the work done by buoyancy through depth h gives you kinetic energy per unit mass w squared, then you combine the two together, you can rewrite the enthalpy flux separating out this buoyancy term. And the term that you're left with, so you get omega squared in here, that gives you rho omega cubed, that's your kinetic energy flux. Or this is W cubed, sorry. And then the term you're left with is Cp theta over GH. Well, G over H is the dry adiabat, so I think of that being like a delta T, a dry adiabatic temperature drop over the boundary layer divided by theta, and the inverse of that. So in other words, if you invert for the kinetic energy flux, rho W cubed, then it's just some efficiency eta times the turbulent, or the enthalpy flux. Okay, so this eta you can think of as some temperature drop across some Carnot efficiency like thing. Okay, so that all is just to say that we're going to use eta as an efficiency. Okay, so here's my conceptual cloud model. I'd like to spend a little time on this, and then if there are any questions on this, please interrupt, because this is sort of the basis of it all. The question for me is, well, why not just a clear sky condition? Why do we have a cloud and not just clear skies? Well, so the simplest setup I could think of is an optically thin isothermal atmosphere. So literally, this is the temperature profile here in my clear sky condition. This, you can think of this as a skin layer up in the stratosphere, where optical depth drops to near zero, and the temperatures are, without shortwave absorption, become isothermal. If you put a cloud in here, then actually what you end up having to do is cool this chunk right here. It actually has to cool that area down in order to drive overturning and adiabatic overturning along some adiabatic profile here. And so that's the sense in which, to me, the stratocumulus mode is driven by cooling from above. So the cross-section of the cloud, you have sigma TC to the fourth coming out the top. Here's our cloud with some updrafts, lofting some hydrometeors through depth H. And it's in radiative balance, radiative equilibrium outside of here. So it's really this layer, this chunk where it's you're having to cool this layer off to get it onto the adiabat rather than whatever the radiative equilibrium is. And that's your inversion right there at the top then. So if we just take the moist adiabatic lapse rate as given, then you can relate the environmental temperature to the TC, the cloud top temperature, just by depth H here. And this will come in handy, of course, because this is the radiative, this is proportional to the radiative flux coming out if you just linearize the for this small parameter here, gamma m h over TE. Okay, so any questions on this? Yeah, Chris. A
couple questions. So one of them has to do with mass balance. So, so if this cloud is turbulent, then it presumably must be entraining. And so what maintains the height of the cloud to be what it is? Are you thinking this is embedded in large scale circulation? Or
particles
are falling out at the same rate as the entrainment is happening? Or?
So that's one of those open ends for me right now. But I have some speculation at the end of how the mass balance closes here. But for now, I'm just picturing this as sort of the velocity at the outer scale, so at scale H, and then there's some maybe turbulent cascade that can change that at different scales. But that's at least a lower limit, I think, on what we need to keep it lofted.
And then what about
entrainment? Yes.
What about microphysics too? That was the other question. For the kinds of clouds you're interested in, exotic clouds that you're interested in, is there some equivalent to microphysics making precipitation?
Probably, but I'm going to sweep most of that under the rug. The sulfuric acid clouds are almost certainly droplets. So I'm just treating these as kind of mesospheres. As you'll see in a minute when I talk about optical depth, I just need them to be larger than the wavelength of light and have a large difference in index of refraction relative to the air around them. And that me theory then applies. Okay. Thanks for the questions. And yes, the mass balance is the big kind of open question for me. Okay, so then just zooming in, then you have this wedge here you got to cool off. And that has to come out as radiation at the top. And so in a bulk sense, it's sort of the heat capacity of per unit area of this layer, which is Cp rho h times w times the lapse rate gamma n. And that has to balance the outgoing infrared radiation at the top. Okay. All right, and by the way, this is sort of how I think of the stability dependence of the stratocumulus existence or depth or whatever. Is that, I guess, what you want is a big temperature difference up here, such that it can cool efficiently and cause a deep layer to form, and so you can do that either by increasing temperatures at up here or decreasing temperatures down here. And that's why the stability, to me, that's at least how my mind works about in terms of how these stratocumulus clouds form and deepen. But again, I'm thinking only steady state at this point, just sort of big picture ideas. Okay, so our next constraint is that hydrometeors must not settle out or precipitate out, in other words, so that the updraft velocities have to be at least the terminal velocity of our hydrometeors. So if you have some monotonic or mono-sized particles of diameter d, then you just work out the force balance between the buoyancy on those hydrometeors relative to frictional force of the updraft. And this is what you get. So the the buoyancy of the hydrometers has to be some drag coefficient times W squared over D, the size. And I'll start collecting these things over here, by the way. Okay, so here's the optically thick part. So this is where I need the cloud droplets to be larger than the wavelength of light, and they have to be basically mesospheres, which makes them really good absorbers of infrared. The optical depth in that case is just the size of these, D squared times N, the number density times H. And that has to be greater than or equal to 1 to meet this condition that it's optically thick. Okay, so N D squared H has to be greater than 1. And I've kind of tried to draw it that way so that this line, this straight line, only intersects that last droplet. Thank you to Chris for helping me think through some of this yesterday. And he said, well, what does that imply for Earth-like clouds? Well, if you take something like 10 microns, he suggested, and 100 to 200 per cc number densities, then to get an optical depth unity, you have to have a 50 to 100 meter layer. That's for water stratocumulus clouds. Okay, so keep that in mind for later when we come back. Okay, so, and then this is the last leg of it. Bear with me, it's a little, there's a lot of scalings here, obviously, but we're just sort of thinking through the problem, or I am. The kinetic energy flux has to be exactly balanced by the work done on hydrometeors, okay? That's a minimum requirement, okay? So everything else is sort of icing on the cake. You can build hydrometers if you want to at that point or do other stuff with the kinetic energy. But at a minimum, you have to be able to lock these hydrometers and keep them there. Okay, so that works out to, this is just M times the buoyancy times the velocity times the number of these guys divided by the area. And the reason I've written it that way is so that then you can use the balance that we saw before from the dissipation, just the terminal velocity scale to substitute out for the buoyancy. And then you can rewrite the number times the mass divided by unit area in terms of n d squared h, and that should look familiar to you. That's actually the optical depth right here. And so it's going to work out nicely, actually, kind of almost too nicely. But anyway, you get this sort of intuitive result that it's going to be proportional to W cubed and also to the area of our hydrometeors. But when you combine it with this effect that you require it to be optical depth unity, all those factors drop out. You just need it to be, you just need the kinetic energy flux to be greater than the drag coefficient times the density of your hydrometeors. This is the liquid density, say, of water, times W cubed. Okay, so apparently, this was news to me. Apparently, suspending hydrometeors being optically thick requires one of the drag coefficient to be larger than the ratio of the liquids to the air that's suspending it. And to me, that's kind of amazing. It doesn't depend on droplet size or number density or anything, or velocities or anything like that. So it seems intuitive to me, I guess. It should depend on CD, it should depend on rho. Okay, so then coming back to our expression, then we have the kinetic energy flux is the amount of work energy done on our hydrometeors. Then we can use our energy balance constraint, the bulk energy balance. So this is our wedge of cooling that's required. This is the radiative cooling out of the top. You can solve for W and stick that in here. Okay, and then what you have is a lot of junk, okay? So this is kind of where I'm at this point. It is definitely a work in progress. It's something I'm just sort of sharing with you. But the balance requires that the kinetic energy flux be the efficiency times the times the enthalpy flux, and you know, just of order of magnitude, that has to be equal to minus R, the cooling rate. Okay, so that's our left-hand side over here. That's what used to be our FKE. And then here's the right-hand side with everything in it. So R appears on both sides. But R has in within it the dependence on temperature, which also depends on the static stability. And so there's lots of little connections that go through here. But in the end, you sort of get this constraint that the left-hand side, which comes from, you know, this term basically comes from the run of temperature decreasing with and radiating cloud tops off the top of that. And then the right-hand side is the dissipation term with the cubic dependence. And you can solve for this sort of graphically, I guess, is the way I think about it at this point. So just plugging in some numbers for Earth, you see left-hand side minus right-hand side, where this drops below zero, you don't expect there to be a cloud. So like anything up to 250 meters or something would, for Earth-like parameters, seems consistent. And then if you go back and ask what velocities are implied, vertical velocities are implied by that, given the moist adiabat, it's about a meter per second to order magnitude. Okay, so on Earth, you get a few hundred meters. So that would be in the planetary boundary layer we're talking about there. If you do the same for Titan, it's something like a few meters. And partly there, it's because the static stability of the environment is very close to the moist adiabat. So you don't have much leverage to get the radiative cooling off the top of the clouds. And for Venus, it's also a few meters. And so I'm probably underestimating, especially for Venus, because as we've learned today, stratocumulus is a topping mode. It's not a filling mode, not typically a filling mode. If it's filling it, we call that fog. So, but this topping mode allows you to sort of concentrate things just at the top of an otherwise dry mixing layer. And so I haven't incorporated any of that into this at this point. So, are there any questions about this so far? Is it too wacky? Am I losing? I don't know. So I'm at this point, I was just explaining to a new friend here that I'm at this point whether this is a good chance to jump ship and do something else. So if you think it's totally wacky, I want to know that, because it's a waste. I don't want to waste my time. Okay, so anyway, Venus and Jupiter's end members, this gets to maybe the question of what's happening to close the mass budget. So we're sort of envisioning that there's these updrafts, but where are the downdrafts? So Venus cloud deck is global, probably not at the poles, though. There's a really large buoyancy flux coming off the poles, because it's basically, it's a very low obliquity of Venus. So the poles are just getting no solar insulation, but they're dumping this, you know, 750 Kelvin blackbody stuff up the top. So there's probably deep water formation there. bottom water formation there is my thought. Okay, so it's more like an ocean in that sense, probably. So that's probably what's happening on Venus. It's my best guess. Have yet to prove that. But so could that balance the upwelling, the net upwelling over the cloud layer otherwise? And then how does this compare to the implied flux due to the cloud granularity that we saw in the UV images? So maybe the mass balance is the mass budget is balanced locally in these at the edges of these granules. Jupiter is, to my, you know, so the big difference between Venus and Jupiter other than size is rotation rate. And so if you try to connect latitude zones with meridional flow, then it just can't happen because you start violating angular momentum conservation and all this crazy stuff. So you end up developing alternating jets. So you're probably all familiar with the striping of Jupiter. And I don't think it's controversial that these are up these are zones of upwelling and downwelling alternating with one another. And so it's probably, locally speaking, you have this global cloud deck, and then it's balanced in the upwelling is balanced in the neighboring downwelling zones. But again, the polar region is probably an exception where there's maybe actually deep water formation happening there too, or bottom water formation, because it's very low obliquity. So going back to this is my conceptual Venus model, where now this is the equator, this is the South Pole, this is the North Pole. So clouds pretty much everywhere, and then downwelling at the poles. The OLR is more or less flat, and the albedo then would decrease at the poles. That's the concept. And there's probably enough data at this point to test this picture, but I haven't done that yet. And then Jupiter, if you look at Jupiter in the thermal infrared, then it does appear to have the upwelling and downwelling regions interspersed with one another. And so along the equator, there's actually a reduction in the emission right at the equator. And there's enhanced emission on the flanks of the equator. So this is where a lot of the power is coming out, in these two clear sky zones on either side of the equator on Jupiter. So, and then down here, I'm not going to speculate because there's a big fight in the community about what's down here. But so I'm not going to say anything about that. But it's interesting that this could contribute to that conversation about what the zonal jets and how they're maintained and how deep they are and so forth. Okay, so I'm just going to leave it with a couple questions, and we'll get to finish early and go to lunch. So one question is, how does the mass budget close in a nearly global mode of stratocumulus? So that's, you know, Chris's question basically. You know, for me, like, one question is this global warming question: what happens in a very hot, moist climate? And I'm sort of thinking even beyond global warming, like what happened in the PETM, the thermal maximum states, and so forth in paleoclimate. But really, I'm primarily motivated by this question of, what are there general principles, guiding principles of how planetary albedo is what it is? Because at this stage, I think we have no idea. So that's all I have. I'd be happy to take your feedback and questions.
Questions?
Okay, so let's just get at a sort of a fundamental setup question. So you're setting things up relative to a radiative equilibrium temperature. I guess I would have thought that it would be natural to, at least underneath the top cloud layer, assume some kind of a adiabat rather than a radiative, some kind of more or less constant radiative equilibrium temperature. Because presumably the stratocumulus is there because there's vertical mixing. The vertical mixing means we're sort of more in a convective than a radiative convective rather than a radiative equilibrium.
That's true on Earth. That's not true on Venus, actually. It's true to some extent because the sulfuric acids are concentrated at the top of the mixed this otherwise deeper mixing layer. Mm-hmm. But the bottom of that mixing layer is at 40 kilometers. And from there to the surface, it's stable. It's weakly stable, I would say.
Right, but I guess in particular what that means is that there's a lot of possibility for radiative heating at the bottom of your cloud layer, because if there's a radiatively transparent layer beneath, and an adiabat, right? So radiation temperature of the upwelling radiation is going to be larger than the radiating temperature of the bottom of the cloud. And so then you get into a situation that I guess I would have thought that Cirrus on the Earth's atmosphere would be a better analogy for, where you're getting, they're sort of being destabilized as much or more by radiative heating at the base. as radiant cooling
times. And then does Cirrus have a diurnal cycle that distinguishes it from stratocumulus?
Cirrus does have a diurnal cycle, but it's the diurnal cycle is partly also driven by its generation. A lot of Cirrus is being generated by convective cloud, which has a diurnal cycle. So I'm not sure what the diurnal cycle of pure Cirrus is.
So two responses. One, I think you may be right. I mean, that maybe the better analogy is with Cirrus, but to counter your point about upwelling infrared, if this is being placed in the skin layer, then the upwelling infrared is already the emission, the OLR. It's already, and so what's happening is you have a very, very strong greenhouse effect on Venus, but the temperature, the radiating level of the temperature is both elevated above that very hot layer and below the cloud deck still. So you're already in the state where the infrared photons are free streaming to space in a way. So it's so I don't think you're going to get, and it's uniform because of the rotational, the weak rotation on Venus. So the upwelling infrared from below is essentially uniform. So I don't know. I don't exactly see how you're going to get differences, local differences in upwelling. Or upwelling infrared from below. But we can chat about it later. I'm probably just confusing it more than
anything. Also, do GCMs of Venus have anything to say about
it? If you want to really break a GCM, then stop it rotating. and in Venus, there are really no good Venus GCMs. I mean, there are valiant efforts, I would say, but the best ones are just now starting to put in microphysics at this point. And so it's parameterized sort of radiative effects of this presumed global deck. But I'm working with a research scientist at UCLA on, we're developing an upper atmosphere model of Venus, which is a much easier problem if you just assume you have this. It's like an ocean sitting down there, basically. That's transferring momentum from the surface somehow. But if you don't care about it that much, then you can focus your attention on this upper layer. So that's where this problem actually came to light for me.
Capio.
Did I understand the arguments right, that you were basically had to assume there's an infinite supply, or there's always some supply of a condensing species, so you're not answering the question, can you actually get the condensing species where you need it to be to condense?
Yeah, that's right. So I'm sort of taking for granted that the condensing species is there. So the picture that I have is sort of from the exoplanet thinking, from that figure that I showed, is that there is a question of whether or not the material is there, and so that's an observational question. But if it is there, oftentimes people will assume there's a cloud if you just hit the condensation curve. But oftentimes that happens like at some elevated level. Well, and it happens in Jupiter's, Saturn's atmosphere for that matter. But so I just didn't have a good conceptual model myself of like how to think about those clouds, how they would form in those layers. So I think that what's probably happening is there's a recycling through this layer. There's a fluxing in a Lagrangian sense, like the moisture's coming in and out of that layer.
Make it hard for Earth, right? Like Chris showed, you can get the from the surface and something can't see from the model that's important for you guys to start the moisture.
Yeah, so that's where I'd like to go with this, yeah. It's put in that layer.
So I'm not a cloud physicist, so I hope you'll
I'm not either.
I hope you'll indulge an amateurish question, but So the presumption of a monodisperse distribution, to me, my intuition would be that you would have a distribution, but I suppose you could integrate that out and still your scaling would still work. But except for if they're very small, in which case the drag wouldn't go like W squared, but it would go like W, and in which case that would reduce the exponents all by one. Have you thought about that kind of thing?
No, not at all, yeah. In fact, I wasn't even aware of that effect, so thanks.
Any other questions?
I think Jim had one.
Just to add a remark. If you look at the fall velocity of biological detritus in the ocean, it's neither W squared nor W. And so its shape of the condensate matters.
Okay, let's thank Jonathan and all the other speakers.